Tonight on Arena, Frank Shovlin talks to us about editing the letters of John McGahern and JLOL on his upcoming performance at Curious Gardens, a new festival in Cork and Laois. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. John McGahern wrote six novels, from The Barracks in 1963 through to That They May Face the Rising Sun in 2002. And there were many short stories along the way. His fiction made headlines, got him banned, cost him his teaching job, and won him acclaim as one of Ireland's leading writers of the late 20th century. Professor Frank Shovlin from the Institute of Irish Studies, University of Liverpool, is due to write McGahern's authorised biography. And he has spent the last 7 years editing the letters of John McGahern, and the resulting book is just that, The Letters of John McGahern, published tomorrow. These letters begin back in 1943 with a thank you note to his father from the nine-year-old Sean, as his family knew him, and go right up to an email to the poet Paul Durkin 4 days before McGahern himself died in 2006. Frank Shovlin joins me now on the line from Liverpool. Extraordinary feat of research, it has to be said, Frank, that you've been involved in over the past 7 years. 1,000 letters are in and around that, and emails involved. And certainly, I'm sure it'll be a help when it comes to the writing of the biography. But let's start with your own interest in McGahern, if we could, and when you first came across his writing and what that experience was, Frank.
Well, thanks very much, and I'm delighted to join you this evening. My own first reading of John McGahern was when I had started as an undergraduate in University College Galway in 1990, and we studied his story Gold Watch for a module on Irish short stories, and it made a great impression on me. One that has never gone away, and that was followed then by reading Amongst Women, and then the collected stories. And then in 93, I was fortunate enough to be taught by John McGahern for a semester in my final year at UCG in a fairly relaxed reading group where McGahern picked a number of books for us to read and think about and write short essays on. So that was a great moment in my education.
I would have thought, so what kind of teacher was he?
He was very calm, quiet, charismatic. He had great authority, but very likable, a very nice man.
Yeah, I suppose that authority is from listening to him any time I heard him speak, there was a kind of, as you said, this calmness about him. But you knew that if you were going to challenge him on anything, you'd want to be on very firm ground, because he knew exactly why he was saying what he was saying about everything. And I guess that comes from his experiences. It is interesting that you open with that note from the nine-year-old Sean, as I said, as he was known in the family. That's the first letter that we get, a simple letter to his father from a young boy. But that relationship was certainly a fraught one. Does it manifest itself right across the letters?
Every now and then, yes, but not enormously. That's the only letter, for instance, that I have from Sean to his father. But there were definitely, problems over the years. His father at one point considered suing John over the publication of Bomb Box, which is a story about a hypochondriac Garda and his son. And that was a potentially difficult moment, but it went away. I think John loved his father and spent his life trying to understand his father. And he says so in the writing of memoir later on in life, that he never really fully understood this clearly very intelligent but thwarted man. And that appears again and again in the fiction, I suppose, perhaps most famously in Amongst Women.
And Amongst Women really was that moment, because you think of McGahern as this hugely successful writer, but as we get in, particularly in the early parts of the letters, we really get this writer struggling initially to be published. Of course, is that first, getting rid of that duck egg is a big step for any writer. But then, the response so quickly particularly to The Dark, caused him such huge problems. Who were those that were involved in the early discovery of McGahern, if you like? And I suppose it was really friends that encouraged him initially, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I would say he was writing seriously from about the mid-1950s onwards. And his most important friends in terms of getting him published were the Swift brothers, a Dublin family. Jimmy Swift was the oldest and became John's closest confidant in the late 1950s and early 60s. And he dedicates the barracks to James Swift. His brother, Paddy, or Patrick, was an artist then in London. And he was editing a short-lived quarterly magazine called X, which is a very high-quality magazine, interested in literature and the visual arts. And Paddy Swift published an extract from the novel John was then working on, which he called The End or the Beginning of Love. And this then was spotted, this extract was spotted by Charles Monteith, the powerful editor at Faber, who wrote unsolicited to John and asked to see more work. So John really, that friendship with the Swifts was absolutely crucial. And then, you know, he got that one lucky break, I suppose, of Monteith seeing the work, and he never looked back.
Yeah, and Monteith, of course, of Faber, the Ulster editor, also important in the career of Heaney, very important in the career of Heaney across, and McGahern, and he clearly... McGahern was never afraid to argue with Monteith, but they had a very openly combative, but you never felt that there was anything personal in the debates that they have.
No, that's true. I mean, and you see the letters change from "Dear Mr. Monteith" to eventually "Dear Charles," and certainly John, if he's unhappy with something, as he often was, for instance, with the way a book was being advertised or the cover of a book. he'll happily say so to Monteith. But he had great respect for Monteith, and Monteith had extraordinary judgment. His own biography would be well worth writing. And as you say, he was very important in the career of Heaney and lots of other Irish writers like Paul Muldoon, Tom Paulin, and so on.
Yeah, but you can go to that one, but you have the McGahern one to get out of the way first.
Well, yeah. Frank, somebody else can do that.
You have a little bit of time before you can get on to that particular biography.
That's true.
But just sticking with the Swifts for a moment, because I think what's interesting is, if you like, I noticed in the letters to the Swifts, there's a kind of a... It is very much, it's an informality, it's an informal type of letter that he writes to them, even though he might be writing about something that's gone on in his own work. They seem to be almost like family to him. That's the relationship he had with them. What kind of a letter writer would you say McGahern was?
I think it varies a great deal from correspondent to correspondent. So as you say, some of the very best letters in the book, I think, are those to Jimmy Swift early in his writing life, where he's very honest. He's very critical of his own work. He clearly relies on Jimmy Swift for aesthetic guidance. It was Jimmy Swift who pointed him towards reading Proust, who became such an important touchstone for him throughout his writing life. And there was another brother, Tony Swift, who was the first of the brothers that John met, and a very early letter to Tony is there in the book, in which John is very open. And I think as his writing life goes on and he gains more confidence, you see that in the letters. So that, you know, some of the later letters, you see, a highly practiced negotiator about who he wants to publish with, when he wants to be published, and so on. So I think it goes from a kind of open young writer, still finding his way in the world, to someone, especially towards the end of his life, who has reached some kind of, I think, happy conclusion about who he is and where he is in the world of writing.
And interestingly enough, this is something you mentioned in the introduction to the book, Frank. You talk about how McGahern's own handwriting changed. Obviously, we don't see this in the book because we get, you know, printed versions of the letters.
Yes.
How his own handwriting changed from the early, young, open man to the later, very well established and very sure writer that he became. I know you're not a handwriting expert or a psychologist in that respect, but what do you think, what's the journey of the handwriting, and what do you think it tells us about McGahern?
I think the journey of the handwriting is, it's the early handwriting, these are nice cursive scripts, and I think this is the handwriting of a school teacher. And it's the handwriting that we were probably all brought up with. I'm sure you remember writing headlines in your school copybook. I certainly do. Yeah. And we were all expected to write in the same way. And John writes in that way as a young teacher. And I think once he leaves teaching behind, the writing changes quite suddenly into a kind of blocky, jagged, small lettering. And I quote at one point a letter from John Montague to McGahern, bitterly complaining about how awful his writing is, and begging him to get a typewriter, which he very rarely typed. Very few of the letters that I found.
Did you find yourself wishing he'd got a typewriter when you were trying to decipher some of them?
It did take me a while, but eventually I could pick up almost everything. There's very occasionally a word that had to remain illegible, but for the most part. But it's not pretty, but you can get used to it.
The content in and around the publication of The Dark in 1965, the story indeed of a son and his widowed father, famously banned by the Irish Board of Censorship for its sexual content. Huge scandal at the time. And some interesting letters around that particular episode.
Yes. I mean, I suppose in some ways that's the best known event of McGahern's life. But I think the letters make clearer a few things. I think John knew that the book was going to be banned. That's not to say that he deliberately wrote it to be banned. I don't think that he did. But he made sure that to be in southern Spain, in rural southern Spain, when the book was published in May 1965, because he knew that there was going to be a war back home. And indeed there was. It was debated in the Dáil. The book was banned. There's to and fro with Charles Monteith, where Monteith hopes that perhaps the ban might be lifted quickly, but it isn't. Faber also knew this. I mean, Faber were also well aware of the Irish censorship regime, and they also, I think, deep down expected the book to be banned. There had been considerable debate between Monteith and McGahern about the barracks and the use of the F word in the barracks. And eventually Monteith backed McGahern and said, yes, let's publish it. And they wondered, would it be banned? It wasn't. So, you know, they were very aware that that was a landmine on which one might step. And that's what happened.
Yeah, I'm looking here. I'm looking at the moment at a letter from April 1965, a letter to Joe Kennedy. Dear Joe, and he starts off just saying hello, basically, and tells him that they're off to Spain. This is himself and Madeline, I think, are off to Spain at this stage. 6th of May is the publication date. Macmillan rejected the book in America in strangely hysterical language. And he quotes, shocked and dismayed, a thoroughly unpleasant book full of sordid details that make the flesh creep. quite a put down. I thought that was coming from the Irish Censorship Board when I saw it first. That's a publisher.
That's right. It's very interesting. I mean, John at the time was with his first wife, Anarchy Laxey, and they were heading off to Spain. And he got this really brutal rejection from Macmillan in New York. Macmillan had published The Barracks in the US in 1964. And Cecil Scott was the editor at Macmillan. And he wrote this savage put down of The Dark. And not alone did he reject it, he then wrote to Faber telling them that they ought to reject it, which they happily ignored and were rather shocked by Scott's position. So, you know, it wasn't just the Irish Censorship Board that disliked what The Dark had to say. And it was a shocking novel for others in the publishing world also.
I wonder what John Charles McQuaid said about it before he sent him the letter telling McGahern to get out of his job. It would be interesting to hear his words describing the book. We don't get that, unfortunately. I mentioned Madeline there and John McGahern's long partnership with her. She was vital to your, really to how you unearthed most of these letters, Frank.
Yes, very much so. It was Madeline who first approached me 7 years ago with a view to editing her husband's letters. And I knew immediately what a huge job it would be. And, you know, Madeline very kindly didn't put any pressure on me, didn't rush me and gave me time to decide whether I thought I could do it. And happily, I said yes. And over the years, we've become very good friends, and she's been enormously helpful, both in terms of supplying, being able to supply me with letters, but also then having extraordinary recall when I would sit down with her for, as I call them, inquisitions, long inquisitions, where I would ask her literally hundreds of questions, which she helped me with in the most generous and gracious way
it's
possible.
It's a pretty full book, but I'm sure there, you know, if, and you went to several places to unearth many of these letters, you've big searching to do. Is there anything, do you think, that you really want to try to find that might help you further when it comes to the writing of the biography?
There are runs of letters that don't appear to have survived, but you never know. I mean, for instance, I would love to see letters to Richard Murphy.
This was his pal and friend in Clegg in County Galway.
That's right. Richard Murphy, the poet, who also published with Faber and who John met through Monteith. Murphy's papers are in the University of Tulsa, Oklahoma, but there appear to be no letters from John, which is a great pity, because I think they had quite an open and friendly relationship through the late 1960s into the early 1970s. Another run of letters that I would love to see, but I think probably have not survived, are to his teaching colleague in Clontarf, Tom Jordan, who read all of John's work through the late 60s and commented upon it. I have a number of letters from Tom Jordan, but not in the other direction. Yeah. But there will be others. And one of the things I very much hope, actually, in the publication of the letters tomorrow, is that there will be people out there who will maybe contact me and come out and say, oh, I have some letters from John McGahern. They must be out there. I mean, I've done my damnedest to get what I can, but you know, it's inevitable that there are more interesting letters out there.
Well, the ones that you have are pretty interesting in and of themselves, and sure, it would be nice to see the others. They may come in time, and we look forward to the biography when it comes. That's The Letters of John McGahern, edited by Frank Shovlin. That's what we've been speaking about. It's published by Faber and Faber. Curious Gardens is the title of a series of one-day festivals taking place in the walled gardens of two of Ireland's historic houses. The first of these one-day festivals kicks off this Sunday, September the 5th, at Donnerail Estate in County Cork. The second takes place just a few days later, Thursday, September the 9th, at Emo Court in County Laois. Festivals feature music, panel discussions, talks and comedy, and feature artists including J.L.L., Cathy Davey, Ham Sandwich, alongside writers like Elaine Feeney, Sinead Gleeson and Lisa McInerney. Dublin rapper, musician and rapper J.L.L. will headline the music offering this Sunday at Donnerail Estate in County Cork. Delighted to finally have J.L.L. sitting across a desk from me as opposed to down the line, which is what the only way we've spoken up to now. Yeah. So great to see you, Jay. Before we have a chat, let's have a listen to a recent single of yours. Yeah. Totally new direction, I think, in lots of ways. Let's have a listen first and you can tell me what's happening here. This is a track called Papi featuring Tabitha Jane.
Before we can plan dates, can you drop a low bounce? Drop a low bounce, can you drop a low bounce? If I daddy your bounce, can you drop a low bounce? Keep on the low bounce. Drop a cold bounce, can you drop a low bounce? Girl, I wanna know now. Drop a low bounce, can you feel your ten toes? I want you to red nose, girl, don't copy those clowns. You're trying to hit wall, but you're kind of thick though. Yeah, so when I hit wall, I'll make your body go wild, yeah.
I go down, love it when I dip along to the ground. Shake it, tell my mind I'm on that now. Cause I'll do anything, I'm a papi, papi. I go down, anything.
The voice of Tabitha Jade doing the singing, the voice of J.L.L. doing the rapping there, sir, in a track called Papi. And great to have you here, as I said, Jay. Sitting in front of me as opposed to down the line. That's a kind of a new direction for you, this particularly that track. It's from the upcoming EP series that you're about to get started, but it comes directly from a trip to Nigeria. Tell us about that and how it's made its way into your music.
Right. So over the Christmas, I was meant to be back home for holidays, you know, seeing family. I hadn't been back in, like, at the time, 7 years or so. So it was all good vibes, etc. But then, with the COVID restrictions, couldn't get back to Ireland, right? Because our flight was through the UK and all the, you know, the COVID stuff. But then, so then I was all restless and everything and thinking, oh, damn, like, I need to get to work. So I met up with a couple of my cousins and friends who were into the music scene there. They introduced me to some people. Those people introduced me to more people. We got in studios. We made some songs. I was watching their process and it was crazy. Like, that's the only place that I've seen, that I've seen personally, where someone's like, oh, yeah, let's make a song. I'm like, yeah, let's do a book, a studio and everything. They're like, nah, we can just do it here. And then they whip out a whole audio interface, a mic and everything. And all of a sudden, we're making a song. And that's how it was happening for most of it.
Yeah. And I mean, if, on the technical side of it, Tabitha Jade, who we heard there, is Liverpool based. So obviously, I'm presuming she wasn't there.
No,
she was
wasn't
in Liverpool. But that kind of technology, we all presume, you know, we've all been working from home and all that type of thing over the past while. But really, in the music industry, this kind of global collaboration has been possible and has been happening well before COVID.
Oh yeah, 100%. It's great. But what happened with this track was it was produced by TY Mix, who's also the producer on See Me Finish, my latest single. And he sent me some instrumentals while I was over here. And then I happened to be going to Manchester for some sessions. And I'm terrible at geography, but I was like, oh, Manchester, there's a whole Manchester-Liverpool rivalry. They must be close to each other, innit? So then I was like, oh, yeah, Tabitha, come to the studio. Let's, you know, record some tracks. And she came down, did an amazing hook, sent stems over, recorded everything, like 3 hours, sent everything over, got it mixed, mastered, all of that.
You mentioned the single there. I'm just to see me finish. Just explain that, because I think it's a phrase, or it's close to a phrase that would be used in Nigeria. Maybe explain what it means.
Yeah, so there's a concept called, there's a phrase called see finish. It's like if someone sees you finish, that basically means that you've lost all novelty. Your presence has lost all novelty to them. They don't care about what you have to offer anymore because you've made yourself too accessible. They've over familiarized themselves with you. They're basically not treating you well because of that. Now they've seen you finish, you know what I'm saying? And we always say the thing where it's like, you have to avoid see finish at all costs. So that's why I always try and not make myself too accessible with people, just in general, because of that mindset avoid see finish at all costs.
Avoid see finish, good bit of advice. And I suppose in some ways that kind of, being too accessible, it is a problem, if you like, or a potential problem of the social media age, that you're so busy putting yourself out there that people just go, oh, I don't want to hear anything more from him.
It's hard. It's a very, very hard thing to do with social media, because as an artist as well, you kind of have to sell yourself almost. But then it can get to a point where people are just hearing from you too much. It's like, for instance, if I decided, oh, you know what, I'm going to release a track a day for the next year or so. The first few will probably do really well, and then all of a sudden I was like, another one. Oh, jeez, you get me? Then they would have seen me finish. It's that kind of thing.
Yeah, see finish again. Good phrase. Must remember it. Yeah. How would you say musically that trip to Nigeria? Obviously, there was the frustration of, but did it bring something new in terms of simply the music you were making?
Oh, 100%. Because I was inspired by everything I was hearing when I'd go, I'd go down the road and then you'd hear everybody blasting music, shops playing all sorts of sick music, like Afro beats. And I was obviously very inspired by that. And when I got into the studio, I was like, I want to make that. Whatever is out there, I want people to be able to listen to me in those settings. So I want to make something that I can hear in those settings. And obviously the producers as well were already thinking in that way. So it was just like, oh, everybody was like, oh, we want to hear JLOL and like an Afro fusion sound, Afro beat sound. And I was like, guys, like, this is something I can do. It's just something I haven't done so far, but I can do it. But everyone was like, no, we want to hear what that sounds like. And it was curiosity out of anything. And then I did the first couple of tunes and like, whoa, this is sick. We didn't know you could. Why don't you do it more often? And that's just a load of tracks came from that then.
But I'm sure that there's going to be more than that style in the upcoming series of EPs, because they're coming under the wonderful title Shades of Yellow.
Yeah.
Obviously, Shades of You. Mm-hmm. You're not going to try a track every day, but you are going to give us a series of EPs that will give us. Is this about really showing us multitudinous sides to who you are and to the music that you want to put out there?
Exactly that. You know, exactly that. You hit the nail on the head there. It's about showing my dynamism as an artist, my versatility. Like, I listen to so many different types of music. I have different interests, etc. So it's only natural that I'll create different types of music and express my different interests in that music as well. So, yeah, man, the Shades of Yellow came from actually a couple of annoying conversations I had with people who were telling me, which I get from a business standpoint, let me just say, but people were telling me, no, you need to have a sound that's recognizable because it's better for your brand and marketing and all this type of stuff. And I just thought, that sounds so boring to me. Like, I didn't become an artist to be put in a box. Do you know what I mean? Literally the opposite reason. So I just decided, you know what? I need to do a series of EPs called Shades of Yellow that shows everybody that there's different shades of yellow, of me.
Yeah, of you, yourself. And I guess that was part of what was involved in an event you were part of in the National Concert Hall in Dublin, Extraterrestrial, celebrated Black Irish identity. I guess part of what you wanted there was there is no one Black Irish identity.
Exactly.
It's shades of yellow, shades of various Black Irish people.
100%. I think it's the same thing. We're all multifaceted people, you know what I'm saying? So personally, I don't subscribe to group identity too much, or I try not to, because I feel like it takes away a lot of my individualism. So I always try and make a point of the many layers of myself. Like, just because I'm one way to you right now, or I present myself in one way, doesn't mean this is me exclusively.
It's the only shade of yellow. There are several other shades of yellow.
Exactly. So yeah, even in that, even funny enough, at shows, when you mentioned that, even at shows, when I do a set, the set list is so, like, there's so many highs and lows, and it goes on such a crazy journey sonically. And I think that kind of sums it up in a nutshell.
Well, you're going to get a chance to do live shows in October. You're at Limelight in Belfast on the 9th of October, the Ocean Dove in Galway on the 14th of October, and Opium in Dublin the 16th of October. And it looks as if things are beginning to open up a little bit better now. That must be pretty exciting to get out in front of a live audience again.
Oh, 100%.
Even if it is only 60% capacity.
Yeah.
We all want more, but it's 100%. Good to get a starting point, I guess.
Yeah, it's good to get a starting point, because for a couple of months there, it looked like there was nothing, no provisions being made for the live entertainment, live music industry. So it's great. It's definitely positive, step in the right direction, and looking forward to getting out in front of people.
Yeah, which you will be doing on Sunday in Cork in the Walled Gardens in Dublin Rail. It sounds like a beautiful venue for a gig, and it will be outdoors. So I guess there might even be more people there now that the restrictions have been lifted slightly. Tell me a little bit. I'm going to finish up with Home, your track Home. Maybe just lead me into this, and I'll help give people full details of the gig afterwards.
So Home is a track, actually. I was talking about group identity there, and there's a track there saying, I'm not one way because of where I'm from, who I, you know, what race I am, my ethnicity. But if you want to get an accurate or more accurate understanding of who I am, the people that I live with and my culture at home is actually more reflective of who I am as a person, as opposed to my skin color or whatever country I'm from, etc. And funny enough, I shot the video during this trip in Nigeria as well, like this one in December. And it was amazing just getting all my friends and family there. Everyone was super excited. Yeah, man, Home.
Yeah.
It was good.
Listen, lovely to finally get to see you and speak to you across the table. And let's finish up by listening to a little bit of Home.
Yes,
good to see you, Jay.
Thank you.
We don't decide, but time will come and repeat the cycle. Well, in truth, we don't decide to freedom fight or seek revival. Because people had to seek asylum with the reek of violence. And you're weeping, so your weakened circumstances redefine them. No chance at reconciling the freedom from freedom fighting. But how do you expect illiterates to read the writing? Left families devastated, got rapidly separated. They happily decorated the fact that they detonated. Bombs on the hour and it doesn't seem to slow up. You go to those kids and tell them they won't live to grow up. See, pure hearted but a few of us ain't. Divided us and then gave us numerous humorous names. And we're forced into acceptance, but who did you elect since? The ones with fewer votes are busy winning the elections. Fathom what isn't.
Home from J-Yellow-L, and he was speaking to me earlier. Current single, See Me Finish, is out now. Watch out for the series of EPs coming over the coming weeks and months. As I said, Jay will be playing this Sunday, September the 5th, on stage alongside the Dublin Gospel Choir, Jafaris and others at Donnerail Estate in County Cork, part of a festival entitled Curious Gardens. And the Sunday lineup at Donnerail will also feature Irishmen Abroad podcast hosted by Jareth Regan, special guest Hilary Rose from The Young Offenders and others, and a host of well-known writers. The second Curious Gardens Festival takes place on Thursday, September the 9th at Emo Court in County Leash. Its own lineup of music and literary guests. You can find out full details about both events on curiousgardens.ie. Based on the acclaimed novel by Ian Maguire, The North Water is a new five-part BBC series which tells the story of Patrick Sumner, a disgraced ex-army surgeon who signs up as a ship's doctor on a whaling expedition to the Arctic. But the ferocity of the elements is matched by the violence of his crewmates, especially the harpooner Drax, played by Colin Farrell. Joining me now is Arlene Hunt, who's been watching The North Water. This is a pretty dark place, but it's dark before they ever head towards the Arctic. It's a dark spot that we're brought to in this series, Arlene.
Yeah, we start off in sort of old England. It's 1895, we're set off, so before electricity and things like that. And we open up with the Colin Farrell's character, Henry Drax, in this scene. He's in a bordello, and he goes from the bordello to a drinking house. He's enormously menacing. Colin Farrell isn't, to my mind, when I think of him, I don't think of him as a particularly big man, but he moves through this with such force that he seems so much bigger than he is. He's just this great hulking, menacing, very dangerous man. He is not above murder at the drop of a hat, and that's from the outgo, from the absolute start.
Even when he goes into the pub to get a drink, he's menacing, as we'll hear in this clip, which is practically, it's not quite the opening scene, it's just straight after he's been in the bordello.
Well, you get a real feel for him here, I think.
Yeah. Colin Farrell, readying to join the crew of the ship called the Volunteer, makes a stop at the pub, but he has no money to buy the drink. That's not going to stop him trying to persuade Chris Hitchens as the barman to give him a drink. Strong language involved here from Mr. Colin Farrell and from Mr. Chris Hitchens.
Rum. Leaving in the morning on the Volunteer. Give you my note of hand. You all look like a fool. Well then, this good knife of mine against the tot of your rum. Heads or tails? It's a fine knife, that. It's not failed me yet. Heads.
Right, it's a fine knife. Well, thank you for this. Now get the fuck out of my bar.
Toss again.
I don't want your boots.
You have my knife. You can't back away now.
I don't want your bloody stinking boots.
I say it one more time, you can't back away now.
I'll do what the bloody hell I like.
Yeah. I'll buy a drink myself if you shut the fuck up. Well, I thank you for it. Been whoring all morning and the whistle's dry.
I do not want to go into that pub with Colin Farrell as Drax.
You wouldn't want to go into that pub anyway, full stop, whether you're with Colin Farrell or not.
No, and Chris Hitchens as the barman there. As I was saying, as we were listening to that, Arlene, and I'm aware that people listening to it tonight are just listening on radio. Even when I was watching it, initially it took my ear a long time to adjust across to the, you know, quite mumbled, a difficult delivery, very heavily accented.
Heavily accented and quite gruff. Everybody's quite gruff, really, except for Patrick Sumner, who is again, but Patrick Sumner's character is slightly gentrified in this. And
this Baxter, is Jack O'Connell.
Yeah, O'Connell. And also Tom Courtney playing Baxter, who's the owner of the Volunteer. He's gentrified in this as well. A lot of people would be very familiar with The Terror, which was a huge hit. And they might think that this is like The Terror, but it isn't, because they're going, you know, up to the Arctic. But The Terror, to my mind, always had gentlemen explorers in it. They were from the upper caste, that, you know, the upper echelons. These men on this, on The Volunteer, even the idea that it's called The Volunteer is amusing to me, because these men are the hardest of the hard. These are not gentlemen explorers. They are not gentlemen anything. They are men who chose the sea because it's only the sea that would have them. And so they don't speak, you know, in a kind of quietly drawing room-esque style. They speak in how they are, and they're very brutal, and they're very quick to anger, and they're very quick to drink, and as you can hear even from the opening clip, they're very quick to violence straight away. You know, that You do have to tune your ear for it.
Yeah, so when a group of men like that are going to go on a ship together to the Arctic, we really are in a cauldron of pressure, of a pressure cooker situation where the slightest, you know, the slightest disagreement can spark into violence immediately. I've only seen the first episode. Does it develop into something, you know, quite tense in that regard?
I think there's a lot of things going, there's a lot of tracks laid down in the first episode. You know, first of all, Sumner has a hidden drugs problem. And then even in the first episode, you know, there's a lot about his history that is obviously false, that he's maintaining this persona, that he's maintaining this story that he has of why he's on that ship in the first place and things like that. And he's obviously lying through his teeth. The captain can see straight away that he's lying through his teeth. The captain's brilliantly played by Stephen Graham.
In fact, let's have a listen to a clip between Jack O'Connell as Sumner and Stephen Graham as Captain Brownlee. And we get a sense of, well, do you get a sense here that Jack O'Connell's character is not telling the whole truth, shall we say?
Well, I'm not expecting the whaling will make me rich. But it will keep me occupied, at least, while the cogs of justice turn.
And we'll find you for you one way or the other. No, your potions don't really make a great deal of difference.
I mean, no offence, Captain, but potions, doctors tend to adhere to science, not witchcraft or superstition.
Well, you'll find the men on board this ship of very little use for science.
Well, either way, I should examine the medicine chest. There may be one or two items I need to add. Replace, replenish.
There's a chest stored in your cabin, and there's an apothecary on Clifford Street. Get whatever you need from them and tell them to send the bill to Baxter.
Oh, Mr. Baxter won't like that much, I imagine.
Bugger Baxter. You don't sound much like an Irishman.
Well, I've been here most of my life. More of an Englishman now.
Is that right?
Yes, Captain.
You know what people call us whalers? They say we're refugees from civilization.
Well, it sounds very appealing to me.
Sure. But you'd be wise to remember that at some point you have to return. Welcome aboard, Mr. Sumner.
Thank you.
Jack O'Connell as Mr. Sumner.
Would you believe him?
Well, funnily enough, when he said the bit about being Irish, I said, oh, we're not doing a great job in the accent. Yeah. And then, of course, Stephen Graham as the captain comes straight out with, you don't sound much like an Irishman, do you?
From Mayo, indeed.
But there's a really interesting line in the midst of that, which really struck me watching that episode, that they say that us whalers are refugees from civilization. And even though they've got to remember that they're coming back, I guess when they go up to the Arctic, How uncivilized does it become?
Well, you have to remember that from the era of it was this 1895. They're not going on ships that are modern ships that can break through the ice. They don't have any facilities on board that could even be construed as comfortable. There's a brilliant scene in it halfway through when they hit a storm on the way up. And they're all drinking and laughing and tilting. And Cavendish is doing this wonderful. That's the first captain, Cavendish, who's a real brute.
And this is a different character, isn't it? Or is that
Not Drax. This is another character called Cavendish. He's the actual first mate. And he's basically just going forward and back with the waves. Even watching it made me feel slightly seasick. Like, and they're all cheering him on. And he's basically going at 180 and straight back up again because the power of the sea outside, this kind of narrow whaling vessels, you know, it's just throwing them around. So by the time they get to the Arctic, you've sort of figured out that these are not heading up there to do like gentle catches of fish or gentle catches of anything. These are going there with rudimentary equipment and rudimentary styles. And their object is to kill as much as they can kill and take on board as much as they can take on board. And how they go about that is particularly gruesome. And it's particularly hard to watch. So
a scene towards the end of episode one, and there's only some seals, I think, that were involved in this particular bludgeoning, but it was pretty difficult to watch.
Yeah, if you're of a sensitive nature, I'd be careful with it, you know. I mean, these are of their time and the actions of the men are of their time. And I don't think it's gratuitous in that way. But this is how they killed seals. And seals at that time, half the time they didn't even know what men were. So they had no fear of them and they didn't really realise how dangerous they were. So these men came out in en masse and they clubbed them and they shot them from a distance and then went after them when they were wounded. It's pretty graphic and pretty hard to watch. Now, they're not extended scenes, but they're in it. And yeah. So you have to kind of watch this. Remember that, again, this is what they do. This is what they are. These are their whalers. And that's their entire job, is to get as much poundage of blubber on board as they can.
And whaling is part of the story for sure. But there's also...
nefarious carry on.
As to why they're really going to be there. Are they going to try to make money some other way? Is there a dodgy insurance claim about to be made? All sorts of things are laid down in episode one.
Laid out. No, I don't think... it's going to go the way Baxter, who's the owner of the Volunteer, expects it to go, because there are so many things that can go wrong that will go wrong, because there are so many violently vicious characters on this that are not going to go down with a sinking ship, so to speak, that they're not going to step back and allow their money to be taken from them. These are not the sort of men that you double cross.
No, I don't think so.
No matter how much you think you might get away with it, these are not the men you double cross.
What is your, do you have a caveat or a kind of a warning in terms of watching this? Or are you saying go watch it?
No,
it's dark,
I say go watch it, because the opening episodes lays down so many, you know, tracks of intrigue that I'm curious to see what Andrew Haig does with this. I'm curious to see how it goes.
He's
on
directing.
I haven't seen the entire series, so I'm very curious to see where he goes with this. And there are so many elements that could go wrong so quickly, and there are so many different characters in this that could go up against each other really, really badly and have a very volatile effect on the thing. I'd love to see I'm very keen to see the rest of the series, and it looks to me like it could be good fun. Also, there seems to be no loss in expense for this. The cinematography is amazing. The actors are brilliant. It's a great cast. You know, this could be fun. If handled right, this could be fun.
All right. So you're looking gruesome fun. You're looking forward to From the North Water. Arlene Hunt speaking to us about the new BBC Two series. It starts on 10th of September. Eileen Gray is one of the most celebrated and influential designers and architects of the last century. As a furniture designer, she's viewed as a true visionary. In fact, the most expensive piece of 20th century furniture ever sold at auction was her dragon chair, selling in 2009 for an astonishing $28 million. The legacy of Eileen Gray lives on, and a new exhibition hosted by the National Museum of Ireland at Collins Barracks pays testament to that fact. The exhibition is called Making and Momentum. In Conversation with Eileen Gray, features new works from the likes of ceramicist Sarah Flynn, sculptor Niamh O'Malley, and artist Laura Gannon. The new exhibition is curated by Irish-born, London-based designer and artist Richard Malone, who joins me this evening. Richard, I suppose people will know you principally as a fashion designer. You've dressed and collaborated with people like Roisin Murphy, Bjork, Deborah Harry, Beyoncé. What is it about Eileen Gray that makes her so influential to such a wide range of artists, would you say? You know, architects, furniture designers, and yourself, indeed, as a fashion designer.
I think, yeah, it's really hard to pinpoint kind of what she means to everyone. I think for myself, I'm definitely more known as a fashion designer. But before that, I studied sculpture, and I've kind of dabbled in furniture design, and my work's in permanent collections for performance art and sculpture as well. So I think what attracted me to her is the spirit that she carried through all of her work. And it's this kind of really single-minded way of creating your own visual language and something that's really kind of meaningful. And I think that she's sort of directed by herself. She didn't really go with trends at the time. She wasn't really directed by where the money is. It was really, I think, like sort of a self-satisfying way of creating everything. And that crossed every boundary from, you know, painting and textiles and rug making to furniture and her famous architecture as well.
In fact, you would probably say that dragon chair selling for $28 million would probably appall her, because she really was not interested in that, even though she did well. She was not interested in that commercial side of things.
And that's something that's really interesting. I mean, she's had a really sort of niche following for a very long time. And now you see sort of since that huge valuation of her work, a lot of people are far more interested in her work, and they kind of equate it to monetary value, whereas much of her practice is actually about using really cheap materials and making functional design. A huge part of what she did was about making things accessible to people, whether that's actually working alongside weavers, local makers in Ireland, the UK, France, even in Algeria. She really empowered artisans as well, and really collaborated. So I think it's kind of a shame that people just look at it as this sort of really valuable, expensive thing, and work often gets spoken about in a way.
Yeah, she was born in 1878, died at the age of 98 in 1976. 15 years, it must be said, before you were even born. Yes. So, and like, there's been a real resurgence in interest in Eileen Gray, I think, in recent years. But when did you actually come across her? You know, I'm guessing a little bit ahead of the curve of the popularity that she's reached, I think, in, say, the last decade.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's, for me, my first kind of introduction to her work came from my grandmother. And I think my grandmother knew, like, we're a family of makers, and makers in the sense of not artists. So it's not like fine artists like seamstresses, woodworkers, carpenters. My dad's a painter and decorator, very working class background. And I think not a lot of people had an education. So I was the first one to actually go to university out of my family. And actually, it was before any of that education that I became aware of her. And it was kind of told to me through folklore, almost, like that someone had this kind of radical queer feminist designer had come from Wexford. And built this sort of design language that kind of really inspired the world and was, you know, largely copied. And I think that it was a very generous way of my grandmother explaining it to me, because she kind of left out that Eileen Gray was from a very wealthy family. That's why a lot of doors were open to her. But I think it really inspired me to be able to kind of inhabit the space of a maker and like envision myself coming from Wexford in a very non-cosmopolitan place to kind of put myself into the role of designer or artist. So I think it was very sort of folkloric, and it almost seemed like a myth, you know, that could happen.
Yeah, and if one Wexford person can do it, says you, then I can do it. That was kind of the story that your grandmother was telling you. The exhibition then that's about to open at the in the museum features were originally exhibited in Eileen Gray's famous house in Provence in southern France, E1027. How did that come about, some of the getting these works over here?
Yeah, well, I was approached a couple of years ago, sort of pre-pandemic, and they wanted to do a showing of my work in the in E1027. So it was going to be the first exhibition they've ever shown there. It was the first sort of artist or designer that was sort of ever asked to show alongside that. And I just thought it was not the right thing to have two people in conversation, because how her work's inspired people, it really crosses every sort of discipline you can imagine. So we set about sort of creating a show that showed all of the different crafts. And I mean, the sense of the exhibition is showing that all of these Irish crafts that are very localized, from like the Mourne Mountains to Wexford to metalwork and glasswork, they're really part of our present, not our history. I think that's a really important lesson that we need to keep teaching people, that we can like reinvest in this. And it was really exciting to show it in the house. Quite a shame that it was so few people could see it because of the pandemic, but it's very exciting for us to see it installed in the National Museum here, where people can kind of view it in a way where it doesn't feel overly protected. They're not in glass cases, you know, everything's really celebrated for its own sort of materiality.
And tell me a little bit specifically, because you're talking again about your own background and your own family background as makers, as you to use the word that you used yourself. What specifically, what have you made and contributed to the exhibition?
Yeah, so I've designed a rug with Catagon in Wexford. So there's a kind of hand tufted rug. And then I worked with Mourne Textiles, who's Mario, his grandmother, founded the place in 1954. And we kind of remade these amazing weaves that are sort of transparent, and you very rarely see them. They're sort of a really expert weave that's quite local to that area of the Mourne Mountains, from wool that was sourced, you know, very locally in on the other side of Mourne Mountains actually as well. So it was kind of bringing together all of these local crafts and celebrating everyone's role within that, whether that's sort of, you know, spinners and weavers. And then I kind of came in at the end with those pieces and made kind of silk appliques to go on top of them, and just responded to that. And it's very much an artist-led project. It feels very grassroots, which is kind of one of the reasons it's so exciting to have it in a national museum, because usually those things can be quite isolating, you know, like a lot of people feel like they can't see the type of work that you want to see in those museums because it's very protected. And I think that kind of spirit the project is that the conversations happened very naturally, and it was very naturally collaborative. And even I have my own work in there as well alongside some of the other sculptors and artists, and it's all about creating a language and a dialogue between all the pieces.
And you were involved then, obviously, in putting together the various contributors, the other artists that are involved there. What was your criteria for choosing those other people that you're exhibiting alongside and that are exhibiting as part of the exhibition?
It was very sort of impulsive, actually. I think that when I was looking at it, it was looking at people who were kind of fearless. Most of them were sort of queer people or women, which they often are. And just seeing kind of them develop this really strong visual language. But it's that thing of having a, there's not a commercial edge to it. You know, it's really about experimentation, and it's really about sort of self-defining and having your own space to make. And funnily enough, when we started meeting with the artists that we wanted to exhibit, there's loads of sort of crossovers between their work and abstraction and form, or whether they're looking at sort of hand-woven pieces, or with Niamh, it's like glass. With Laura, she works loads with sort of Irish linen that's then has layers and layers of amazing paints and oils put on it to create these reflective surfaces. So there are things that you can see a thread through maybe Eileen Gray's archive, but also each of them kind of stands on their own as an individual. And I really wanted it to represent sort of something that's optimistic. After the couple of years we have, it feels very forward thinking. And it's really, for me as someone making in Ireland and the UK, it's really nice to see that that's still happening and that there's still a huge energy for that and a real push for that. And I think now more than ever, it feels really necessary to support those things.
Yeah, and important to say that the works will be auctioned off as a part of the restoration of Eileen Gray's celebrated house. But finally, how much of the spirit of Eileen Gray do you take with you when you're working with Bjork or Beyoncé or those others that you work with in that fashion world?
Well, I think it's what I always find it interesting is like I have this really weird space coming from rural Wexford where people kind of overlook you, where they think that you're not kind of a serious contender. But it's sort of seeing my work go into the MoMA and like being one of the youngest artists they've ever celebrated in New York and seeing them alongside these other artists. I'm like, it's really about spirit and it's not about academia, because with my background, I always find that quite isolating. So even when you're working with someone like Bjork, there's this sort of single-minded vision. And I think that those kind of people are kind of like mine, so they get attracted. And it's the same thing with sort of Eileen Gray that I see as well, and the same thing that I've seen with my grandmother.
Well, good to bring it back to your grandmother and back to Wexford in that fashion. Lovely to speak with you this evening, Richard. Thanks for being with
you
us.
Too.
That's Richard Malone, curator of the exhibition of the new works inspired by and celebrating the life and work of Eileen Gray. The new exhibition is called Making and Momentum, will be on view at the National Museum of Ireland, Collins Barracks, from this Saturday, September the 4th through until September the 24th. And that is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock.